Hey, everybody. This is the Brothers Wisp number 48. Slightly different one. We've got a new member of the crew to basically attack, ask him as many odd questions randomly as possible. So we're going to do it counterclockwise today. Today we have David Atias, veteran New Yorker out of California. Say hello, David.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, that lovely voice of yours. Moving on, we've got Mike Hammett from Chicago, Chi-Town. What's up, dude?
Not too much. Regular viewers of the show notice that my room is getting messier and messier with every cast.
I think your wife is just shrinking the room. She just squeezes the walls in. All your crap starts piling up together.
Yeah.
And then finally, Andrew, you've come back to us. Andrew Cox. He's still in Australia. I'm just messing around.
Oh, cool accent. I didn't get a chance to hear him talk yet.
Join this winter.
Yeah,
I'm fine.
He sitting outside with a jacket in Australia. Excellent.
I think you were the last country that Trump insulted. How do you we're not going to get into politics here, but just a dumb fact.
Oh no, we always do.
Politics or get insulted? Which one?
Well,
a bit of both. Excellent. Well, let's jump right into news. We don't have a ton, but I think there's some decent stuff, and then we'll go on with our assault on David. So number one on the list, Mike, again, all of these lovely juicy news bits come from Mike. One of them actually came from Andrew Thrift. I'll point that out somewhere in here. But top of the list, high density Wi-Fi with MikroTik, which I thought was interesting. There's a group called Smart City that's apparently doing event venues. And it looks like they are at least claiming that they're doing it with MikroTik. That's the first time I've ever heard of anybody doing high density Wi-Fi using the MikroTik stuff. What's your what are your thoughts on that, guys?
Jaws on the floor. Like, what? How? What made them think that was gonna work? Like I looked through some of their venues, and like, it's some big time stuff. You know, NFL stadiums, things like that. That's a playground of ruckus,
Cisco.
Serious stuff.
The big boys.
Yeah, I'm not gonna mention those guys suck.
They're in a lot of stadiums, though. They've got a lot of footprint.
But so then hearing MikroTik mentioned in that same space was like, what? Does this work?
Yeah, I think also, too, if you kind of read between the lines, some of their articles says MikroTik gateway devices, and they talk about hotspots. So maybe they're just using them for the hotspot aspect and kind of user authentication, you know, grabbing them and redirecting kind of web page hijack. Maybe it's just that.
I
want a definition on high density from that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a fluff piece. You could tell it's really just advertising Smart City and not really trying to give you any meat. But I thought it was somewhat interesting.
At the convention center, NFL stadium and convention center, all kinds of other big convention centers. So it just seems like those all seemed like the playground where you'd have something like purpose-built, high density.
Controller-based, right? Something that's got some central intelligence, right? If you're in a big high-density environment like that and you just have 200 MikroTiks, they're all going to be independent access points. There's not going to be any collusion amongst them. So they'll all fight for clients, and it's not an ideal situation by any stretch of the imagination. Not to say it can't be done, because I've seen it done, and I've actually gotten surprising amounts of throughput in environments like that, but I don't think it's easy to do.
Now, let me ask you this. So I know that it's an antiquated technology and really nobody uses it anymore, but how would WPS, wireless distributed says WPS, yeah.
WDS?
Right? WDS, I'm sorry. I'm not a wireless guy. I'm just going to point that out. And I know that WDS has some sort of communication between the other access points that are in there. I know it's limited to a very small number of access points in the WDS group, but would MikroTik at all work at all in that environment using that? Or
Well, I think the only time I've ever seen WDAS used is kind of a rinse and repeat. So, like, pick up a signal and then rebroadcast it back out, as opposed to actually sharing client information amongst access points. You know, because it's in a normal environment, an AP is going to hear a client broadcast to jump on the network. And so they'll all say, oh, you can connect to me, you know, and then even when the client chooses one to connect to, they're still going to try and fight for that client. You know, I think even with WDS, they're not going to, the other APs won't understand to cease attempting to communicate with that guy, at least initially.
I had a client that had a situation where they had high density Wi-Fi and they needed some decent access points. Now, I wasn't involved in this because I will not ever take a wireless customer unless I only take jobs that I know exactly what to do and exactly how to accomplish their task. But he was telling me that the wireless that he likes to use is something called Arrowhive. And he said those work really well.
Yeah, I've seen those worked, especially where's some of the like in ISDs and school districts, I've seen it there. I know one of the weaknesses of Arrowhive is if you let your license lapse, you can no longer connect and configure any of the APs. So
wow, even if you own the hardware, you cannot connect to it and configure it.
That's right. They'll continue accepting clients and working. You just can't connect to them to change any configurations.
Or I think the Cisco Meraki are one step further. If you let your license lapse on those, they just become an expensive brick. You can relicense them at some point, but they don't work at all after that.
You know, speaking of relicensing, have you heard what Fortinet has been doing? So has anyone not heard of Fortinet?
Yeah, I've heard of Fortinet.
Okay, good. I used to be a huge fan of Fortinet way before Microtech days. And back then, you let your license expire, and they were like, whatever, who cares? You know, when you want to renew, you just have to pay your renewal fee, this and that. Now, if you let the license expire, let's say you skip a year, and then a year later, so it was 2 years since you last bought a subscription for 1 year, so you have this one-year gap. They make you pay for the gaps that you haven't renewed your license, so... That, I think, is really sneaky, tricky. I think that's an awful business practice.
That's interesting.
I mean, it may work for the investors, but not for the customer.
What if you buy the device off of eBay and it hasn't been covered for 2 years?
That is the loophole. I've heard people doing that and getting around it.
But just claim it. Oh, I definitely bought it off a guy named Jim, sold it to me. He hasn't had a license for a few years. Can I get up there?
With their license, they could see where the license was transferred to which reseller. So I guess it kind of sucks that way. But anyway, shooting off topic.
No. I mean, that's where the best... Yeah, never. No. This was all planned. We've led you to this point. You just didn't realize it. I think it's the natural evolution of our industry, license-wise, because all these manufacturers are making hardware now that's so powerful that it's generations. I mean, it's huge time gaps now. In IT, you know, 5 years is a lifetime. And so I've still got equipment that's... Right? I've got equipment that's... I've got equipment that's 10 years old and still... Not necessarily in the core of a production network, but, you know, just aggregating users and things like that. And so equipment nowadays basically just lasts five ever. So it's sort of hard to...
I do the same with my VoIP servers. And instead of actually replacing them, what I do is I keep them on. I add a new server to my cloud, and I'm in three data centers. So I'm doing this about once a year to every data center. And I just add a new server, but I keep all the old ones active. So if one fails, you know, the other one picks up. But honestly, I still have not had a server fail. So it's, hardware has definitely become a lot more reliable, depending on the vendor. But
I was going to say, especially like if you think about like switches, how often if you're aggregating users, unless that thing completely dies, there's virtually no reason to ever upgrade those things anymore. Especially as inexpensive as a gig switch is nowadays, and users aren't really pushing those things. So
not at all. I've never seen someone max out an entire switch.
So if you're not pushing the hardware, as hard as you used to be. And then, you know, having a lot of refreshes, you got to come up with some inventive way to make the investors happy, keep your pockets fat, you know. Yeah. How else are you going to pick up those next two yachts and maybe your private jet? Got to get that bonus somehow.
That
trophy
wife.
There you go.
Well, honestly, but that's what I love about the networking industry and as a whole. Network principles don't change that much. They kind of build on what was happening before, and it doesn't change too much. I mean, what's been the latest thing in the world of network engineering? I mean, think IPv6, and even that's been around for a couple of years. But have we really seen any new protocols come out or anything like that come out?
A lot of augmentations. Go ahead, Andrew.
I think there's always new stuff coming out. There's always people working with new technologies. But as you said, I explained it to someone like this the other day. Networking is this big series of building blocks, and you can build a network with all the blocks you have now. You don't have to go out and buy all the new ones, but as the new ones come in, you just add them to your network. So
yeah,
you might upgrade the foundations, you might add a couple of pieces on top. You work with what you know and what you have, but as you bring in the new ones, you just add them to the collection. You don't need to have an all-encompassing understanding. You don't need to know about everything that's new. But as it becomes available and useful, you put it in there.
Cool.
True story. All right, so I saw Andrew on the Google Doc here. He bumped up AT&T buys Viata from Brocade.
Yeah, I think we were talking about Fortinet. Let's go to some free systems instead. It's,
yeah.
It's very interesting to see AT&T making that sort of move, but...
Well,
I think it
makes sense for them to own that sort of stuff.
Viata was open source, and then Brocade picked them up and then closed sourced virtually everything, right? I think there were some forks. I know the Ubiquiti Edge routers were based off of a fork of Viata at one point.
Isn't pfSense a fork, or is that something totally different?
I think pfSense isn't that built off of OpenBSD?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pfSense is definitely OpenBSD. I don't know if the routing system is the same, though. I can check that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Viata. Wasn't Viata supposed to be the open source equivalent of Cisco CLI? Wasn't that their big, you know, claim to fame when they were open source?
No. Viata, am I crazy? No, I think Viata is more more like Junos, I want to say.
Really?
Unless I'm insane.
Yeah.
I think they're more programming sort of language. It looks more like a script, I think, than Cisco CLI. Like, what was it, Quagga and Zebra, I think, were very Cisco-like routing engines that were open source. I guess they still exist.
Actually, Quagga has been getting some new legs lately, so some people have picking up dev for kind of make white box switching a little nicer.
Am I crazy, or didn't Cumulus just fork Quagga, or was it something else that they forked?
It was Cumulus and Quagga.
Yeah, and supposedly in the open source world, forking is not usually a good idea unless you just absolutely can't come to a compromise with the development team. You know, if there's some kind of showstopper on the team wise. So I think they openly said they didn't want to do this, but it was something they had to do.
Like, you don't really hear much of Quagga anymore. You know, you go back 10, 15 years ago, you know, people talked about Quagga, and now it's like, let's just use it as like a historical footnote. So like, it's just been abandoned so long that it just wasn't, you know, the amount of work, you know, either the amount of work to get there or the people maintaining it just weren't willing to, you know, go those directions. And, you know, obviously they have been very successful with what they've been doing so far. You know, well, lately, I should say. You know, meanwhile, all these SDN white box guys are, you know, setting the world on fire. So they're going to do it one way.
Just to elaborate on that that Quagga fork, that was to the free range router is the new system, and it was like Cumulus, Sixwin, Big Switch, and a couple of others that basically said there are too many patches, too many bugs waiting to be fixed. There's like some huge backlog of like a few thousand bugs, and they just wanted to get it sorted. So they were like, we're going to do this to fix it on our own. So.
And they could do it. I think Cumulus already announced that it's going in their next revision of code. Like, it's, we're implementing it quick.
I'm curious. Why did AT&T buy that? Why did they buy Viata? Is it so that they could use it in their, in what part of their company, or just business buying another business?
I think my understanding is that it's an SDN play, right? To kind of roll across. Yeah. So it's, I guess, a proven software-based router that they can roll into their automation. Does that sound right to you guys?
Yeah,
that's what I thought it might buy it for.
Yeah, it's got support for all the standard hardware you'd expect to see. So I know Viata works with all of the standard Intel gear, so you could basically chuck it on an Intel box and have yourself an 80 gigabit capable router, or like 80 gigabit port, and that going back and forth. It's already there. It's ready to go. So then it's just about them rolling it out to their network. And
so do
that,
you think,
makes build out a lot cheaper than going out and buying, say, Cisco or Junos or...
So do you think this is AT&T sitting back and watching and seeing what Facebook's been doing and seeing what Google's been doing? You know, they've gone and basically gone to the OEMs and said, this is the box I want you to build it, and then put their own software on top of it, and very successfully so, cut out the major vendors.
They've the major telcos have been talking about, you know, network virtualization for as long as it's been a thing. But, you know, no one ever assumes that the telcos can actually act with any degree of success in any reasonable amount of time. And AT&T, maybe whatever direction they were going wasn't getting them where they wanted to go for, you know, hosted firewalls, hosted VPNs, hosted whatever it is they're, you know, doing for their customers to try to remain relevant. And they say, well, what we're doing, you know, doesn't work. So let's just get this Viata thing.
I think it's probably a bit of let's sit back and let somebody else forge the path first and then follow in their footsteps.
Well, they're always at the forefront. Like, you know, any new announcement, you know, AT&T, Verizon, you know, they're always there saying, oh, yeah, we're doing that.
We're doing that. Yeah, the asterisk is we're doing it in a lab somewhere, and we have no plans of putting this in production, but we're doing it. Absolutely. All right. So let's keep trucking. Mike dug up. He's got his fingers in a lot of pies. He dug up that Microtik is dropping a dual band groove. It's just made it through FCC approval, and you can click the link and look at all the pictures of the internals. So you guys know what the groove is. It's the Microtik bullet. Isn't that what Ubiquiti used to call those?
Pretty much, yeah.
Do those still exist, the bullets?
I think so, yes.
In America, they definitely exist.
They're free in America. Just hang out in the wrong place.
Because actually, I think they did make some AC. Like, wait a minute, if someone needs more bandwidth with a bullet, just upgrade to a dual chain radio instead of going to AC. Microtik looks like they've done the same thing now with their groove. They put multiple bands in it. I don't know if they're concurrent or
curious. Because I mean, the groove, that's one connector. You know, that's one
what is that? Chain.
So you screw it onto an antenna. So I guess you could use a big
one
Omni
or the other.
Yeah, I mean, it could be one or the other. I mean,
so silly though, right?
I'm not smart enough to know if you can use the same antenna at the exact same time for two different frequencies. I'm assuming that's a thing, right?
If the antenna doesn't care what you do with it.
Yeah, yeah. This is a radio capable.
It's just usually they're more tuned to one frequency or the other. Yeah. And then most of the time you only see dual band antennas in, you know, relatively low gain omnis.
Yeah.
I remember on, was it like the old CM9 radios, those little mini PCI cards where you could choose, like, you know, it was a dual band radio, but like you can only choose one. of them to use.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's how this is or not. I didn't read into it.
Well, let's look on their website.
I don't think those are announced. I think it's just dumped on the FCC right now.
Oh, forget it then. All
yeah,
right.
It's kind of a back channel.
But take a look. This is the new MikroTik. What is this? This is the model Cap Light.
It seems to be targeted towards the same market segment as the in-wall AP.
Yeah, and those I can see like in the hospitality sort of area, like right? Where you've room. Got the only thing I don't like about it is that it's 2.4. So even then, you know what I mean? Like if they were 5 gigahertz and they were that small, you know, and you're covering just a hotel room, you could drop one in each one. That'd be pretty solid. I just wish they were pumping out more 5.
As someone who's rolling out that sort of gear into residential apartments, think like it's frustrating just how many of the devices are small, but 2.4. And like,
yeah.
Well, is there any reason nowadays to not have dual band gear? Like especially in that noisy environment, like, at least with 5.8, you've got the walls kind of blocking out signal from one unit to the next, so you can have one device there and not be interfering with the 20 units around you.
Well, even in that instance, I argue, why do we even need the plethora of 2.4 gigahertz stuff that's coming out? Do we even really need 2.4? Like the cap? I think I would be fine if they only had 5 gigahertz versions of those little Cap minis or Cap lights or whatever those things are called. I think if it was just a 5 gig version, I'd be solid. Like,
I think dual band
gives you the support you need for everything. So
maybe they couldn't do it in the same form factor.
Maybe,
but
I like dual band because I have a whole bunch of Chromecasts all over the place in my house, and they're the old ones, but they work just fine. So I have dual band, the HAP ACs. I got them all over my house on 2.4 and 5 gigahertz. And yes, I have a ton of other APs in the area, but mine will just talk the loudest. But yeah. I think it's just to support those legacy, you know, devices like an old Chromecast.
Even then, the HAP ACs, I think if they just made a smaller form factor device like the HAP AC or a higher volume, I love the HAP AC, but I also don't want to pay $45-$50 for them. I wish there was something small that was just 5 gigahertz or even dual band. If it was small and something closer to the $25 range, like these things are, right? As cheap as these are, if we could get them in 5 gig, that would be a game changer in a lot of scenarios, I think.
Throw them all over the place.
The Ubiquiti AC in wall, well, being AC, obviously has 5 gigs, so it would be a dual band radio in that tiny little form factor. And it's only a single polarity per band, but you know, you don't really need much more than that for hospitality.
Yeah.
You know, about those in-wall things, I think I saw them, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you do need to run an Ethernet to them, right?
Yeah, because they're PoE powered on the back.
Great. Why the hell can't they just do a power line network adapter? So you put that, you plug it directly into your wall AC power from wherever the fuck you use in Australia. What do you guys use? Like DC 600 volt? Everything in Australia is
240 volts.
All right. But wouldn't it be great?
My stuff works from 110 to 240.
All right, cool. But wouldn't it be great if Ubiquiti came out with that in-wall little thing where you don't have to run Ethernet because existing homes aren't going to open their walls just to run Ethernet. I use Powerline network adapters everywhere, and they work fine for me. But if Ubiquiti came out with a Powerline network adapter, in-wall, whatever, and then you have an Ethernet port and it's wireless.
I think, too, it would be cool if somebody came out with like a DSLAM sort of model. You know what I mean? But not, you know, obviously it's not DSL, but it's a DSLAM that hooks up into the power lines, and then you just have a little, you know, quote unquote modems at different spots to pull off of there.
There are some of those that exist.
Are there?
I think hotels use those.
Yeah. Like probably 8 to 9 years ago now, we were looking at some of those for hotels, but back then they were ridiculously expensive and you could only get sort of 15 megabits across them.
Oh, that's useless.
Well, what would be the advantage of that over like power line network adapters?
Think of like an MDU.
It's just a central. Yeah. So you have a central one connecting out to a power line adapter in every unit. So.
Solid. Well, speaking of Microtik and beating up Microtik, we've got a link here to the MUM videos. So all the stuff that was recorded was online. Actually, within like 2 days, they were Johnny on the spot about it. So David's got a he's got a video up on doing some VoIP stuff. I've got some up on using Microtik to troubleshoot. Wilson has one up, and Thomas Kernack has one up. And then, you know, the other people that we don't care about have stuff up as well. People that aren't in the circle. You guys don't care.
If you're listening in, Greg loves.
That's lies. Lies.
By the way, Greg, I just want to say that with the light over your head, you look like, you know, baby Jesus. It looks like you have a halo on top
Angelical?
Of you.
Angelical? Right now. I'm very ethereal. Look at me. You're welcome.
He waxes every morning.
Be blessed, my son. Let's see.
But another tangent on the power line stuff. One of the vendors that is in our space does have a new beta power line deal. It's supposed to be 1200 megabit multi-point system, up to 32 endpoints.
No way! Is that IgniteNet? Or can you not say?
Well, because most of the beta things are always, you know, beta discussions stay in the beta forum.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably Ubiquiti then, if you're saying beta.
But
even whether he can confirm nor.
Just
throwing it out there.
One of those things is out there.
I'd be curious to see what that ends up looking like. Let's see. Mike put up a piece about Cambium change in support policy. Is this monumental? Is this important? I just saw it and it sounded important.
I hate it.
So it just personally annoys you.
I told the guy too. I responded to the email. What did I say to him? I said...
Well, first explain to us what the change in support is.
Sure. Yeah. I suppose that's probably useful.
Yeah.
So with the vendor, it's somewhat typical to email support at whatever for support. It seems like a normal thing. Well, not with Cambium anymore. Email 3 days ago saying, oh, by the way, as of 8 weeks ago, you can no longer email support at cambiumnetworks.com. You have to call us or go to our support portal and enter a ticket.
Oh.
And my thought is, I'm on a tower. I just had something die. I want to grab my phone, email, support at Cambium. Okay, this unit is bad. And then, like, you know, they do the, you know, describe it. And then when I get home, there's a ticket waiting for me with more information. Like,
so what you're really saying is... You don't want to wait till you get to the bottom of the tower to do that. You want to do it right there while you're on the tower?
Yeah, because I'm going to forget if I don't. And I have. I forgot to file our maze on it because I didn't do it immediately.
All right, well, send an email to yourself with the details.
And but so, you know, they have this big... Well, like, I mean, there's the change in the policy, which is bad enough.
Right.
But then there's, by the way, we changed this eight weeks ago and just now telling you. But so I responded saying that change, not to mention notification of that change 8 weeks later is unacceptable. that's what I told the Cambium Director of Global Services Customer Support.
I can't wait to do that to you. Change something, not tell you about it.
And so that really annoys me.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Tom asks them all the time, so go ahead.
How is calling a company not good support? I think that's the quickest, best kind of support, unless it's call the company just to open a ticket, and then someone will get back to you. So what kind of support over the phone are they giving?
I have no idea. I don't know. I'd never call them.
I'd say try that, because customers, I got to tell you, my customers call me. You know, when I tell them, send an email to support@pennytone.com, even though it goes into my ticketing system and I can track and manage everything, I think maybe I just spoiled them too much, and they just always get me on the phone. So what I do while I'm on the phone with them is I just go into my portal, I put in their email address into the ticket, and then now we have notes and a paper trail of what's going on. But it's apparent in what I do that people want to call. So sure. When you said that KBM is changing, going from a ticket system to calling, I'm like, well, that sounds like an upgrade.
Well, you can go to their website and enter the ticket yourself, or call them. They've disabled the email to ticket functionality. Like before, you sent me an email and it generates a ticket. I'm like, every help desk I know in the world supports email to ticket.
There's free ones. Spiceworks, it's free. You know,
you disable that.
It's because it's changing your workflow that you didn't like. You were able to go on a tower and just whip open your smartphone and be like, ticket to support. You know, here's my problem.
So I'd just like to point out, there's probably a small bias in the VoIP guy recommending people continue to call each other into the future.
Well, if they have a problem, if their phone's not working, then they can't call him. So that's definitely how he wants them to try and get a hold of him. Makes sense to me.
If their phones don't work, they call me from their cell phones, like machine gun call me.
So. You heard him, folks. Boy. Call him and email him. Machine gun. That's how I heard that. Let's see. So moving on from Cambium, IgniteNet MetroLink 2.5 gigabit gear. That's pretty bananas. So that's their 60 gigahertz stuff still, right? They're saying 2.5 gigabits per second.
5 gigahertz radio too. So it's 60 and the backup 5.
So it's correct. So before their MetroLink, and so I'm looking at distances. It looks like they have two models. They have a 19 centimeter and a 35 centimeter. 35 centimeter, they're saying up to a mile. Is it?
Sure.
How are they getting? So 2.5 gigabits per second. That's adding send and receive together, right?
That's aggregate.
All right. Are they? But it's only a gig interface on these things, right?
Nope.
It's a 10 gig interface as well.
These new ones have a 2.5 gig copper, which is strange to the, you know, carrier space, but the enterprise space is starting to get a lot of those for, you know, AC access points in the enterprise come with 2.5 or 5 gig copper now. And then they also have a 2.5 gig SFP, which I'm like, at first, and I'm still a little confused, like, you know, why would you do that? I mean, GPON is 2.5 gig, and, you know, knowing some other things that they talk about hybrid fiber wireless, so 2.5 gig for GPON, okay, that makes sense. But I can't use that in anything else.
Why not just stick a 10 gig interface on there? I mean, I can go to Fiber Store right now and pick up a 10 gig NIC for like $16 or something. Is that multi-mode or single mode?
Single mode, 10 kilometer, I think, is 36.
All right. So if I'm doing multi-mode, I can get it even less.
I don't think so. I think it's the same price.
Is it? They're usually a little bit cheaper. Anyway, why wouldn't I just do that instead of having to have specialized switches with specialized interface and specialized optics? Because I know these are going to be more expensive than my regular old Fiber Store $35.
No idea.
Okay. All right. I just want to point out
that IgniteNet has their own switches in their product list, and they have 10 gig uplinks on them. So like 10 gig SFP plus ports. So it's a bit of a strange one there. I do really want to see this product in action. I do really like what it what it means for us.
Yeah.
Having that 60 gigahertz, backup 5 gigahertz, like a lot of CBD shots are going to be really good for that sort of thing. And it looks like they have it up on the, there's been a few units already out on the beta store. It's supposed to be coming in the next couple of weeks. I've got one of them heading to me for testing.
Nice. Yeah. What's the street price on these things going to be? You guys have any ideas?
Starting at $500.
$500 for the, is that per, for a link or per side?
Per side. Yeah.
Per side. Is that 35 centimeter or the 19 centimeter?
The cheap one is $500.
Oh, yep. So the bigger one's going to be more expensive?
$50 a month.
Oh, that's, it's almost like, what's the point? Why not even just get the bigger one?
That's what I'm saying. But, I don't know. Yeah, so here's one of the fiber switches.
Find it. It's in your drawer.
With a bunch of SFE and SFE pluses, 1 gig and 10 gigs. How do I plug in this 2.5 gig radio?
Eh, you got me.
I'm sure they'll have new ones.
Yeah, we heard everything there, by the way, David. You didn't actually mute yourself. Okay.
It's all good.
Let's see. I'm excited about those things. Yeah. And I think Gen 1 of the Metro Links was, like the Ethernet interfaces maybe had some hardware problems, but they've ironed all that stuff out for a pretty good while, right?
Yeah.
All right. So just in case anybody's had a bad taste.
Can we just go a bit further into Ignite now? Like it's I always find this business so strange. The collection of products that they have at the moment, and I haven't looked at the interfaces on the Metrolink, but I've got one of the Gateway AC1200s that I've been playing around with for a while now, and it's almost like they're not sure what they want to do. There's like the cloud product that works for those gateways so you can manage them all. Then there's the Metrolink, which is really for WISPs or people making sort of point-to-point links. And then there's like the Sunspot and the Spark and those bits and pieces. Like, it's hard to tell where these guys are going and what they're... I would genuinely be concerned as to how long my product would be supported and would be upgraded, and like if it doesn't work out of the box, there's some bugs and things. Like, what are they going to do with this? Is they going to be? Are they going to move into the residential space? Are they going to?
Huh.
At the on the switch side, IgniteNet is owned by Acton. I think that's how you pronounce their name. Who also owns EdgeCore, SMC, and a few others.
Been around for ages.
Like, yeah, those are big names.
Yeah, these switches are more or less just EdgeCore switches with the IgniteNet quality stuff added on. So I suspect that those probably work, as advertised. I haven't heard any complaints about their, Spark and Sunspot and whatever else their other things are. I have to say that I've heard of many people using them. We've got one of their gateways. Actually looking at their Wave 2 AC, if I were to do some sort of MDU play, it's a new MIMO access point for under $100. Can't go wrong with that. Assuming it works. I think what they're kind of trying to target, because they have the multi-point on the Metrolink as well. So I think what they're trying to target is in some of that, less than last mile type applications, doing multi-tenant facilities, doing, small subdivisions, things like that, where they could do 60 gig, last mile delivery to a house. Kind of all that sort of thing. I don't know.
Well, the other thing I know is that any of that cloud stuff, the devices that are going in an apartment or in a residential space or even in a business, they the whole cloud controller aspect of it basically allows them to integrate third-party solutions. So I know that there's like what they call Content Shield is the DNS filtering, and Sticky Wi-Fi is a business intelligence solution. And basically they're going out and finding the providers of these things and going, hey, can you integrate with this? I talked with them in my role in Bright Wi-Fi and how we might do some business together there. So they're pulling all these different bits and pieces in, but it's like, is that the whole jack of all trades, master of none sort of thing, or it seemed to be a bit clunky at times when I was working on it with the AC1200 gateway. But the hardware itself seems all right. So
they've just recently started doing some beta work on their family zone content filter, which is supposed to be a little more sophisticated than just that basic DNS one. I'm behind on my own testing of that, but you're supposed to have, you know, an app and all kinds of stuff to go along with it to, you know, have kind of a, you know, all-in-one home management solution for, you know, families and such.
Does that really sell?
And if not, I just told them what to do. So,
I mean, Disney Circle. Disney has a product out called the Circle, which is content filtering for families. It's they've gone a bit further and they've actually made their sort of childproof. So this device it intercepts and it broadcasts its own wireless signal, and it's got a battery in there as well. So if the kids unplug it, it continues working. So there's obviously a market for it. I know I've talked to some of the guys in our business about that sort of product before. I'm just not sure how, where the demand is for it. But there's definitely parents and things out there looking for ways to police their children's access, monitor what they're doing, restrict their internet so they go to bed at a certain time. So.
Interesting.
Maybe even some rogue nation states would be interested in this sort of thing.
Or the CIA. All right. So moving right along, I saw a video that Thrift put up about some Kiwis that built a nationwide carrier network for like $1 million over in New Zealand. And it was brilliant. I love these guys. I don't know if you... It's about like a 20, 30-minute presentation they did at Nanog 70.
38 minutes.
It's Limelight Networks. They've become quite well known from their humble beginnings. If you have a look at the pictures of fiber running across the middle of fields,
yeah, with full of sheep and stuff. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, and sheep don't really like to eat fiber. They get it up in the grass.
Yeah, and he's talking about rats chewing through and making sure you use fiber on the inside tube so that the rats don't get to it, and that's just insane. And then dropping bunkers for repeater sites just randomly without permission on like army property, and it's I loved every bit of it. Right, it's so
like
Wild West.
John
Wayne,
how many bullets can you dodge and still create a provider? Like,
oh, it's brilliant. And then they were like, well, we could have done like this expensive thing, but instead we just got really cheap switches and put them in there to take the Ethernet and then boost it back up and fire it back out another 80 kilometers. I just love that. And so like a big chunk of their network was just a bunch of daisy chain switches to rinse and repeat the signal and keep it moving. That's pretty brilliant. But they said all in all that you could, between major cities at that time, to get a 10 gig wave or 10 gig connection between them would be, you know, $100,000 a month or something like that, something crazy. And then their service cut it down to like 10 grand a month, right? Which is at least back in the atmosphere. So I think they said that they started out building it for, it was all sort of pieced together in a crazy fashion for about $1 million. And when they sold, it went for like 116 million or something like that. So it's pretty good return. It seemed like a really good group of guys just doing everything they could, you know, really scrappily to make it happen. I love it. I love an underdog story. I think in every big business, there was a point at which they were hanging by a thread, or they did some crazy stuff just to make it work, just to make it happen. And somehow or another, they pulled it through. And I think that's very much one of those stories, very near and dear to my heart. All right, a couple more Mike has in here. Mimosa picture contest. What's that story?
It's already over. So
why'd you bother putting it?
But I mentioned it because Faisal from Miami made some epic pictures. I've shared them on our Facebook page. I know that publicly he's been trying to get C5Cs for like a year. And at one point, you know, in the public dialogue anyway, he was talking about, getting Jamie Fink from Mimosa some like, authentic homemade hummus type stuff, and then whenever he got the C5Cs. And so then he's made some pictures about, A5C looking for like a Craigslist, back pages ad looking for C5Cs.
It was pretty brilliant. I saw that.
Drew a C5C on a piece of cardboard, put it on an antenna. There's some really great stuff. You guys got to look at the Facebook page.
Yeah, desperately seeking C5C or something. Yeah, it was pretty brilliant. All right. I'll tell you what, we're coming up to the 50-minute mark, so let's save that one for the next cast, and let's skip down to David so we can get a little runtime on this kid. So David Atias is with Pennytone, so he's our resident VoIP guy. He's from New York City, that's why he's so douchey, but he's been in California since 2014. So you've been there 3 years, so it's kind of gotten a little of that out of your system, and... now you've done several presentations at the MUM on using MikroTik. So as you guys can tell, he's an old hat. He's been using MikroTik for a good while. Big advocate. So if anybody thinks you can't successfully use MikroTik in your VoIP networks, this guy's here to tell you you can. Let's see. I'm going to fire some questions secrets. Off. Yeah. But give us a little of your background. So how'd you get into this VoIP stuff and ultimately start using MikroTik and... how you are, where you are today.
I'll give you the 10-cent tour of my life. So basically, I was doing IT services for about 20 years. And prior to 2008, I learned some of the highest-end technologies, some really fancy UTM firewalls and, Citrix and all sorts of servers and remote access stuff, and dabbled a little bit in cloud computing in its earlier days when it was only like really VMware out there. So I was pretty much selling really high-end solutions, and customers were buying it. So at around 2007, 8, 9, the crash happened, and everybody tightened their belts. And what was the first thing to go, or at least that I think was the first thing to go, one of the first things to go, was spending money on technology, that's when Microsoft launched a campaign about do more with less. So everybody on that had in their heads, no, we could do more with less. Great. So IT services kind of went down the toilet. They took a big hit. You'll always have the bottom feeder IT people out there, installing printers and my mouse doesn't work kind of thing. Yeah. But for the section of IT that I was in, which was managed services, that really took a big, big hit. And I saw that it wasn't going to recover so quickly. I saw the way the industry was going. Everything was going cloud-based. Everything was going on, don't buy the software, just, rent it sort of $5 a month, and you get all the Microsoft Word, Excel document, Word and Excel and every other software they make for a very low fee. So yes, costs were coming down, but things were happening residually. Now, I am way too stubborn to stick and do something that makes money if I don't like it. As you can tell, I tell what's on my mind, and I'm not going to fake doing something that I don't like. So
that's why you don't strip anymore, right?
And oh, yeah, I still do. But,
yeah, there you go. So but, when did Pennytone start? When did you start all this stuff? Is that about 2001 ish?
Actually, Pennytone started in 2010, in the summer of 2010. But okay. I was doing hosted VoIP before that, and it was still kind of meshed with IT services. So I started. I really started VoIP at around 2006.
All right. Well, how about the MSP sort of thing? Was that 2001?
Later. That came at around 2008.
Okay.
2009, around there. I think it was 2000. No, I'm sorry. That actually started in 2010, actually, yes, because I bought my first server, my first multi-tenant VoIP server, like January 5th, I believe it was, in 2010. And that's when I started becoming an ITSP. And again, just to get back to like what I like doing is that it still involved a lot of network engineering. You really can't be in the VoIP industry if, first of all, if you're sane, because it's one of the most complex, one of the most difficult services to deliver. As you know, Greg, you know, latency and jitter and uptime is like, has to be 100%, right? Because Greg does data centers and he gives 100% SLAs.
It's bananas.
Yeah. And so basically you're the recipient of every problem on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're the whipping boy.
Greg is so, every problem on the internet.
So, I'm not a cat. So yeah, therefore I am a problem.
So I got into VoIP because it heavily relied on network engineering, which is my love. And that's really my claim to fame with VoIP. I mean, forget about how I got my sales and forget about my customers, but how I got so involved with MikroTik is I was trying to find such a product that was inexpensive, that customers wouldn't flip out over if they saw it. If I told a customer, here, you know, we're going to install you a VoIP system, and here's the firewall, it's going to cost $2,000. They're going to be like, what? You know, they're going to bark at that. But if I say, hey, it only costs, you know, $160 for the firewall, or if for bigger networks, like $350, they were like, all right, whatever, just do it. But the point is, the MikroTik did such a fantastic job at prioritization and queuing. I mean, I don't know another product that does it as good, because MikroTik has some proprietary queuing algorithms that I haven't seen elsewhere. If any of you guys are Cisco guys, maybe you could tell me, but I haven't seen it in any of the other firewalls like FortiGate or WatchGuard, or I hate SonicWall, but they definitely don't have it.
ASAs don't have it. Cisco routers, no. It's super clunky to do HTTP and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up here. And I actually fell in love with the philosophy of MikroTik. I mean, aside from their wireless stuff, which honestly, I in my opinion, I believe they are far behind for the enterprise level of wireless. They are definitely, you know, losing the race in that respect. But when it comes to function, price, and usability, really, I think MikroTik is a real winner. Anybody could learn it. I mean, even if you have no money, go out and get a $25 MikroTik, download this software, I mean, and start using it. But that's how I got here. That's how I'm on this show.
You've never hit a lower point in your life. Yeah. That's pretty rough. All right, man. So I've got a few questions queued up. One is, what is your favorite flavor of PBX?
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a really good one. You're asking me for my secrets.
Not necessarily. Okay, give me your top three then. You don't have to tell me what your real favorite is.
No. I'm going to be completely transparent, because I'm a person that believes there's enough business out there for everybody. So the first thing I'll say, and kudos to them, is the multi-tenant PBX system that I use is called BICOM Systems, BICOM. They are a great system. I haven't seen any major bugs. There's one little bug that I have to kind of prove to them that it is a bug, because it happens very infrequently, so it's hard to catch. It doesn't really affect anything. In very specific scenarios, and it doesn't always happen.
All right. Is that open source? Or is that a pay-to-play?
No,
or?
BICOM is based on Asterix, and they have an all-in-one PBX, multi-tenant PBX system. They also have a call center edition. And they have their business edition. They have desktop apps. They have smartphone apps. And it's actually affordable. And one of the things I told BICOM when I went to the Channel Partners convention, and I was at their booth, I was helping them sell because their salesmen needed to, they needed to be whipped a little. And I, and they were just, when you're a salesman, you got to be like a pit bull. You got to get out there and bark at people.
Yeah.
But the one thing I was telling everybody that walked by the table, I said, hey, what's your interest in BICOM? You ever heard of them? They're like, yeah, we heard about them. I'm like, what are you using now? Anything? And they said, yeah, we're using this other software, whatever. And I said, do they charge you residual? Have they taken a cut of your profits? Every user, every license, everything like that? And they said, yeah. And I'm like, well, how much of it is going to them? Is it more than you would like or less? And of course, they always say, well, it's way more than I would like. Yeah. So what ended up happening was I told them, well, BICOM doesn't charge you for that. So why don't you go over there and speak to them? And I'm not getting paid by BICOM for this. Again, it is a big secret, but the truth, they've done well, and I've used them since day one. Now, they're just the software side. The other flavor of PBX that I like really is Free PBX. Free PBX is just wonderful. It's easy to use. I do miss Trixbox CE. I really do, because it had HUD. And people that have used HUD, it's their desktop app. People that have used HUD are addicted to it. And I still have a couple of customers that I do hosting for PB Extra, which is made by Funality, which makes Trixbox. They're still using it, and they don't want to get off it because of HUD. So that's their strongest point, and call centers use it. So obviously PB Extra is Funality's version of their PBX. I don't think they sell it anymore.
Yeah, I used to love Trixbox. I was an avid Asterisk at Home user, and then they actually transitioned into Trixbox. So from way back, I used to love them.
Well, now, unfortunately, Trixbox CE, from last I checked, because it flipped up a few times, is not available anymore. Now they kind of rope you into Trixbox Pro, which is cloud-based, and you know everybody's going after the residuals. I can't blame them.
Yeah, for sure.
It's just sad because, you know, when you're using open source software, you should have an open source version of it for everybody to use.
And when you're saying CE, that's Community Edition, aka free, right?
Yeah. And they kind of revoked that. You can't find it anymore. So that's sad. But those were really my favorite. Free PBX. And I just actually, that's what I was using to do a lot of the testing I did with SIPALG at the Microtech MUM. I didn't want to use my systems. I just wanted to use something separate that I could really just mess around with and see what the results are. And it turned out that, yeah, I was using Free PBX and absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I use Free PBX for a couple of different things. One is their Web Meet Me. You ever use that? Where you can schedule like meeting conferences? Yeah, yeah. I love using that for our Cisco call managers. That's what I use for our Meet Me system. So you just spin that up, have a trunk, and dumps everybody in. Super easy to use web interface, so even my salespeople can go in there and create their own conferences and put in the time and duration. Super nice.
I think that's a commercial plugin, though, right? That's not free.
No, it's free.
What is it called? I got to hear this.
Web Meet Me.
It's cheap. Doesn't pay for anything.
Oh golly, brother! I reuse toilet paper. Just give it a good rinse.
Oh, nice.
Flip it inside out. You're solid. Two ply. You split it in half.
It's got two sides.
Yeah, there you go. It's got inside and outside. You just split the two ply, wipe, you're good.
By the way, whenever you have a group of guys talking about stuff, poop and toilet paper, one of those two will always come up in a conversation. It's just been validated to me. Thank you.
I've got an 8-year-old and an 11-year-old boy, and so it's 90% of our conversation. So I just it bleeds over into everything else for me. Cool. All right, so now that we've talked about your favorite PBX, what's your favorite actual handset? My favorite thing is in my office, I love picking up an actual physical phone and having a conversation. I don't know, maybe that makes me an old man, but I hate having a phone call on my cell phone. So
I don't blame you. I can't stand it either. And in my, I'll show you my, in my office right here, I have like 3-4 phones. I'm always testing different phones. And I always, always don't come back to the Polycom. I come back to Cisco. Now, I'll tell you the advantages of Cisco, and I'll tell you the advantages of Polycom. So Cisco, like right here. This is a Cisco SP, I think 303. Cisco SPA 303.
Is it a SIP?
Great phone. Great phone. Okay. It's got two-port switch in the back. It's great. The only disadvantage of this one, this model in particular, is just you cannot add an attendant console. And I'll show you an attendant console in a second.
Yeah.
So I'll untape my phone from my laptop screen because apparently Skype doesn't work on groups. So anyway, in Skype. So here's my favorite one, honestly. It's right there. I hope you can see it. That's my Cisco phone, and you see it has the attendant console. And I got to tell you, when it comes to auto-provisioning and it comes to configuring it, you know, from a centrally managed place, it really, in my opinion, it's the winner. I love it. Their config file is very easy to read. It's almost like plain English. They last forever. The sound quality
forever.
Is... Forever. Yeah, forever. I haven't had one go bad, honestly, in the... Since 2008, I can't remember having one go bad.
Yeah, I mean, I've still got 7960s that have been deployed for 11 years. I mean, the older skinny style ones, you know, but
yeah,
they just work. They are tanks, man. I love those. I just bought a pallet of them. I think it was not really a pallet, like a big box. There was like 72 phones, and I ended up getting each one for about $3.15 a piece. Right. Yeah. And they will last. I mean, they're going to outlive me. Absolutely.
Well, the 79 series, not the SPA series. Yes. When Greg says the skinny ones, he meant skinny as the protocol, the SIP signaling protocol, skinny. So that was Cisco's proprietary. And as good as it is, it actually, you know, SIP just took over.
Yeah.
So now all the SPA phones are SIP compliant. Those are good. Trump has one on his desk, and he has a new Cisco phone on his desk. And that's probably because they do encryption very well. They do it at the phone level. They can scramble everything. Even the phone's OS is encrypted. So you can't even go into the phone if you're locked out. But I like Cisco because of the easy use. I like it. It's easy to configure. Their config files work really well. If you look at a Polycom config file, good luck. It's like reading Chinese backwards and upside down while you're drunk. So the Cisco phones are my favorite. There is one drawback to Cisco. You can't do hot desking with Cisco. So hot desking, does anyone not know what hot desking is?
Is that where you log in, you sit onto a phone, you log in?
Exactly. So Cisco doesn't have that functionality yet. Maybe they will in the future. I hope they do. So the first thing I ask a customer when selling them, they're like, which phones do you like? I say, well, I like Cisco, but let me ask you, are you ever going to do hot desking? And I make sure I get that answer for them. Because if they say yes, then I'll have the option of giving them either a Polycom or, believe it or not, a Yealink.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Yealinks, in their earlier days, I had a lot of returns. They were just frying left and right. And they got their act together recently. And so far, the guys at Bicom love it. The guys at Baltic Networks love Yealink. I've set up a couple of their customers with Yealinks. They said, you know, this guy needs VoIP, but you got to get the product from us. And I was like, sure, no problem. What phones do you sell? And they're like, Yealink. I was like, all right, let's use Yealink. And Yealink's proven to be really well in terms of cost. Yealink would be a little bit cheaper. They do have built-in BLF buttons, which is something that a lot of customers want. And BLFs are just, technically it stands for a blinking light function. What is it really? It's a button that when you press, you can configure it, or the admin or I can configure it to do anything. It could be someone's extension. And if they're on the phone, that button, that BLF button, will light up red. If they're on the phone, you can make it feature codes. So BLFs, I always tell my customers, you're going to want an attendant console, as you call it, sidecar, but you're going to want BLF buttons. So Yealink is the most cost-effective to have built-in BLFs. Polycom is expensive all around. They are good. They are great phones. I've had a little bit of difficulty trying to provision them. When I say provision, I mean flexibility on what you could do with that config file. You know, it's hard to read. As a human, you know, my servers will auto-provision anything. But I like to go in and custom edit the config file so I can really dial in exactly what the customer wants. And I can do that with Cisco. I can't do that with Polycom because you have to use a Polycom configuration server, and it's a real mess. But the phone is great. It is the most expensive of the three. So, again, personal. Oh, and the other wonderful thing about Cisco SPA series phones. And here's another one, by the way. I have it on my desk. This is like a shitty little like kitchen phone. I mean, look at that. It's literally that's all it is.
It's so cute. That's the cap light of the Cisco world.
Yeah, honestly, this phone is useless. It doesn't even have a speakerphone option. This is good for, you know, the back door of a building. Before you leave, you could dial the code to turn on your alarm or whatever the hell. I mean, it's absolutely a plain Jane phone, but it's also $60 and it's Cisco. Mm. It's not PoE, which sucks. So I don't recommend that one. But the beautiful thing about the Cisco phones or the SPA series is this headset. This headset has a 3.5 millimeter jack. Now, this headset costs $12. All right. So you could give full solution to a customer. You know, the receptionist and the people that are on the phone, the most salespeople, they don't want to hold the phone to their ear like this and get a stiff neck at the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, and when they say how much are headsets, well, Polycom headsets, you're spending big bucks. You're spending easily upwards of $140, $150 for a headset. And if that headset breaks, you're crying. Or if you're not the owner of the company, you have to go ask the owner for another $150 headset. Whereas if this thing breaks, hey, boss, could I order another headset? How much? $10. Go ahead. Have fun. Break them all day long. Yeah. And again, this is 3.5 millimeter. This is the Panasonic KXTCA 400. Works like a charm.
So, booyah. All right.
That's
so
why I like Cisco.
Physical phones. Now we're getting into WISP territory because, you know, everybody's cheap. So if you were going to say favorite PC software client, right? So I've seen some people like call centers, instead of having physical phones, they'll do like a little headset straight into the laptop and they'll use an app of some sort to do all the communications. Do you have you said Bicom actually has a PC client, right? So is that normally what you just go with?
Well, it's not free. That's one of the things that they charge monthly for.
Right.
It's very affordable. I'd recommend it. I like it.
It's solid, reliable.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. It's got a chat client on it for all the other people in your organization. It kind of reminds me of HUD, but without the click and drag kind of features.
Hmm.
And you can see who's on the phone with who, how long are they on the phone.
Well, that's cool.
It's nice because as an administrator with the Bicom software, you could just right-click and barge or right-click and listen or right-click and whisper if you're training people. So that's kind of nice. A lot of admins like that feature. But, you know, if you're not using a Bicom client, I mean, I've had great success with Zoiper on my cell phone. I love it. It's very easy to use. For people that are using Windows, I would probably say X10 iBeam Counterpath. It's like really all the same company. People seem to like that. But that's pretty much it about soft phones. I don't really use them too much.
All right. How about on a smartphone?
On a smartphone, Zoiper. But here's what I want to say about using a VoIP client on a smartphone. I don't recommend it ever unless you absolutely have to. Because think of it. If you're on a service like, well, I'm not going to name names of services, but let's say you're on a carrier, a service, a cell phone service that doesn't have very good coverage, and you're going over VoIP, over a cell phone connection, that's data. Now, what happens when you have a bad signal? The first thing that drops is your data, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not on LTE, your data is so awful and so jittery that it's not even usable, even using a GSM client or a G729 client. It's just, I don't recommend it at all. I really, really don't. You're better off forwarding the call to your cell phone's phone number than actually use a soft phone on your phone.
Gotcha.
That's my opinion. That's my opinion. That's what I've seen.
Well, what if you say you got a smartphone app on your phone and you're at home and you're on the Wi-Fi and you want to dial in and work from the house? I guess, was that
go
a
for
little
it.
Better?
Go for it. The only problem with that is that when you receive a real call, that automatically puts your your soft phone call on hold. And that happens unpredictably. So you could be making a big sale and you're ready and everything is looking great, and then your mom calls, and you know, and I'm a phone company. If that happens to me and I'm trying to sell somebody something, like, where'd you go? You know, like, that's not acceptable. And I make sure I don't use a soft phone for that reason. Soft phones are nice. I don't use them.
All right. So here's the big question, the big follow-up for all of this stuff, right? This is a WISP podcast, although I think we're getting more and more kind of MSP folks all the time, to be honest with you. I think to me, that's sort of the direction that MikroTik is really pushing people, these big beefy routers, right? It's really appealing to the MSP. Anyway, having said that, we still have a lot of WISP guys that listen to this. And a lot of them are doing the internet-only play. Some of them have been playing around with, hey, I'm thinking about doing voice. But, right, it's not their forte. It's not their strength. There's a lot of apprehension associated with it. There's a lot of apprehension with, you know, what happens in my network and jitter and latency and all that stuff. So I think sometimes it's easier if somebody can just hold their hand, right? So how do you feel about a WISP breaking in? Do you think they should partner with somebody like a Pennytone? Or do you think they should just ease into something and kind of use case? Like, how would you recommend somebody dip their toe in to get started?
How do I say this without being biased? Yes, of course I would love WISPs to partner with me. Are you kidding? Of course I would love that. Who doesn't want more business?
Right.
The truth, look, when I got involved, I was in for a huge, rude awakening. I thought that you could just buy a server, set up some clients, go into a great data center, get great carriers, and everything will be fine. And it was anything but that. Like, it was almost disastrous, because it'll work when all conditions are good. Okay, but I tell people VoIP is is built like a house of cards. I mean, one card is weak, your entire castle's falling down, and I mean literally, one link is weak and you are up shit's creek. You better know how to remedy that. You better know how to prevent it. And last year at the MikroTik Mom, I gave a speech on VoIP problems, how to correct, detect, and avoid them. And I pretty much gave a lot of information about, well, that one was just with prioritization, which I found has been easily over 90%, close to, I'd say 95%, if I actually sat down and did some math and go through the trouble tickets. 95% of VoIP problems are on the customer's network, because customers' networks are never configured as they should be for VoIP. You know, small networks work great when you're doing bullshit, when you're sending emails, when all your traffic is TCP, you know, when traffic can be retransmitted, even DNS or anything else that's UDP, but VoIP has to get there right the first time and come back right the first time, all the way across the internet, all the way to your servers, all the way to your carriers, all the way to the other person's phone, and all the way back. Right. I totally forgot the question.
All right. So I'm a WISP, right? And I'm thinking about dipping my toe in. What do you recommend the best way to do that? Should I spin up free PBX, try and figure that out, play with it? Or should I, do you give people the option of like calling you up and say, hey, David, I'm a WISP. I'm new. I want to dip my toe in. I want to see what this is like. How does the provisioning process work? Can I throw up a couple phones and we see how it goes? Like, how do you recommend people get started in this? Because honestly, I don't have a good answer. I know what I would do, because I want to do it guy. I want to put my hands on it. I want to turn it around. I want to figure it out first. Right. So I would spin up free PBX and I would probably start playing with it. And I say probably, and I have done that, right? I've been doing VoIP for a long time too, not to the scale you are. So I'm not even going to pretend to be a VoIP guy. I know just enough to get me thrown in jail sort of thing. but what would you recommend to people? Like,
Here's what you do. Start free, okay? Start free. Get free PBX. Set up some extensions. Get familiar with how call flows work and some of the features that are involved with VoIP. Set up phones locally and set up phones remotely outside your network. And you should be doing NAT. I want them to do NAT for that specific reason, so they understand what ALGs do. So free PBX. And you know what? Free PBX, you could put it on a Raspberry Pi. And it works. I've stress tested the Raspberry Pi and free PBX up to 22 wow. concurrent calls without a problem. All right. So the new Raspberry Pi, this is the version 3. This is what I used to practice on for the presentation I gave at the last month. It works like a charm. This thing's like $50, $60. I mean, there's no reason why you shouldn't have it. So I'd say free PBX on a Raspberry Pi. I wouldn't virtualize yet because that introduces some problems you may not want to deal with yet. So put it on physical hardware first. Again, set up some physical phones. Forget about soft phones. I want you to get even this cheap $60 Cisco phone. All right, get one of these. Get two of these, three of these maybe, right? Three of these, let's say. Set one up local to your free PBX Raspberry Pi box and set up one across the internet, wherever, in someone else's office, someone else's house, and start playing with it, okay? And see how the call quality is through there. Now, you're not calling out to, like, somewhere else. Maybe you can if you want to install, like, a USB modem. But if you want to get started with something very simple, very easy, start by doing that. Play with calling extension to extension. Learn how free PBX works. Learn how VoIP works through the internet, through your router. And you know, while you're playing with free PBX and making calls, get on the phone and watch some high-def videos on Netflix while you're doing this. And then see what happens to your call. You know? I don't recommend you play with different codecs. You don't want to transcode on anything yet. Right? That's when you're converting, when one phone is using, like, let's say, GSM. And then on the other end of your call, after it's gone through the server, the other phone is talking and using the codec of, let's say, ULAW, all right, or speaks. Both phones have to transcode. The server's going to have to transcode, and maybe even the phone will have to transcode. You don't want that. So in your setup, stick to ULAW. I just had a customer, Home Chef. They found me through MikroTik, and they were having VoIP problems, and, you know, we checked their bandwidth. They had like gazillion gigs of bandwidth. We checked their firewalls and nothing was being overutilized. So I was like, you know what? We're still getting jitter, but this is not real jitter. I don't actually see jitter when I'm opening and inspecting in Wireshark. So it was actually the transcoding. You don't want to transcode in the beginning. All right. So stick to ULAW. It's uncompressed. It's universally accepted on every VoIP device I've ever used. Free PBX is free, and start doing that. And I'd say, start from there. But for WISPs have a very interesting challenge. Is prioritizing traffic over wireless has always been a problem with wireless. All right. And I think you guys might know more about that than I do. I know enough to stay away from that. I know MSS is supposed to be a protocol that helps prioritize. I was told by, I'm not going to name a name, but by a giant in the industry that understands wireless probably better than anyone I've ever met. And I haven't seen him on your show, but he said MSS just doesn't work as it's supposed to. So the first thing any ISP has to do before introducing VoIP, especially wireless ISPs, is you better understand how to prioritize traffic properly. Prioritize and queue traffic properly. Otherwise, don't even think about offering VoIP as a solution. And just to elaborate on that, I told the customer, he called me and he wanted VoIP. And he's way out in the mountains. He's using wireless shot to get to his location. And I told him, I don't want to take it. He goes, well, who do you suggest I go to? I said, I don't know, call Vonage Business, right? So he actually, no, wait, listen to this. I don't like giving away business unless I know it's just going to be a disaster. So I told him, call Vonage Business. He goes, you know, I called them. And they told me, once I told them that I have wireless uplinks, they told me we're not going to give you anything. No, we are not giving you service. Forget about it.
Huh.
This is fine. This is a salesman telling a customer, no, we're not giving you service.
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean, so phone calls, right? So jitter is where latency is inconsistent, right? So it'll be 10 milliseconds, then it'll be 50, then it'll be 10, right? It's like moving back around. So if you have a consistent amount of latency, that's usually easier to deal with, right? It's when you start getting these inconsistent latency spikes where things get a little strange, right? Up to a certain degree.
Sort of. You said two different things there, actually, and they're not related, but right. They can be as a result of what the problem is. So The three things that will affect VoIP call quality is latency, packet loss, and jitter. And they're all different, and they'll manifest themselves differently.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So latency is, I mean, how does it sound in a call quality? And I spoke about this in the last year's MUM, so if you want, you can watch that, but I'll tell you here anyway. So I'm talking to you right now. I'm speaking. How long does my words take to get to your ears?
Right.
If it takes 200 milliseconds, that's, you know, all right, that's a little delay. So what ends up happening is I don't know that you're – I see you on Skype and you're pausing and you're not talking, so I think you have nothing to say. Meanwhile, you didn't even get my words yet. So that's delay. Jitter is technically is called packet delay variation. And I don't like that definition because it's not the variation in when packet one and packet two and packet three come along. It's not the variation. And I've had conversations with people about this that we go back and forth on, and I'm like, no, it's not the variation. You could be from 1 millisecond to 20 millisecond back to, like, you know, 10 millisecond. And that's your packet delay variation is, let me put it to you like this. Jitter is the time it takes for packet one to get to you, then packet two to get to you, and packet three to get to you. That's really what it is. If there's too long of a delay between the packets, you end up hearing something like this. So people call it the robot voice.
Best simulation ever, by the way.
Yeah, I call that motorboating. I'm pretty sure that's what that is.
Yeah, there's like four of them on this floor right now.
most advanced protocols now, like voice transmission protocols, are designed to be able to absorb some certain amount of jitter, right? Isn't it? Delay variation, isn't it when there's a large delay variation, there's a big spike in that, isn't that when it actually becomes noticeable? And like even with latency, I'm just going to keep asking questions and never let you answer. Even with latency, isn't it okay as long as it's a consistent amount of latency up to a point of what, like 120 milliseconds, like people won't necessarily really feel it too much as long as it's less than that?
About the human mind, the human brain can't comprehend too much the 125 milliseconds. That's like an eighth of a second. I mean, it's almost non-noticeable.
Yeah.
Yes, but what the other thing that you said about, what was the other thing you said?
There the was jitter. If it's like, say you're at 10 milliseconds, and then all of a sudden you get a spike up to 200 milliseconds, and then it comes back to 10. That's when jitter really becomes a problem, right?
Well, here's how to alleviate that. And 200 milliseconds is already way too much.
Because
you're talking about jitter buffers now, right? And they are dynamic jitter buffers and they're static jitter buffers. So dynamic jitter buffers, depending on the phone you're using. And again, you want to do a jitter buffer at the endpoint. So you want to do it at the phone. If you do it at the server and the server still has to send the stream to the phone, you may incur more jitter along the way. Hmm. I like to do it at the phone level. So Cisco phones obviously have a jitter buffer, and you could set them to be static or dynamic. But what jitter buffer does is it receives enough packets, even though they're coming in at different times, it receives enough of them. It buffers them. It puts them in a temporary holding memory, and then it lets them out evenly. So you're introducing delay with that process, but you've eliminated jitter. You understand?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the phone's just storing everything. So even if there is that delay, it's just kind of piecemealing everything out so that you don't really feel it.
Yeah, but with 200 milliseconds, you're gonna feel that.
You're gonna feel that. I guess it's, say, 100 millisecond spike. So it goes from 10 to 100, and then back down.
I like to see jitter levels lower than 50 milliseconds, because more than that, you have to add the milliseconds of jitter. Add that to your overall latency, and that's going to be your overall time that it takes for the person's voice to get to the call, you know, the person they're calling's ear. So
talking back on your 125 milliseconds is what people can detect. You could theoretically have a latency of 60 milliseconds and a jitter of 60 milliseconds, and with a jitter buffer in place, still be an okay call.
I'd say acceptable. Now, there is one other thing that you haven't touched on yet, and that's packet loss. So you can't do anything for packet loss. Packet loss is packet loss. All right. So once it's gone, it's gone. It doesn't retransmit. So
right, because all the phone traffic is UDP, right? So it's just blasting it out.
Yeah, and also the traffic has to come in. It's good to have a little bit of jitter buffer, even if you don't have any jitter, because RTP packets, which is the voice part of an IP call, has to come in order. So the packet numbers must come in order. Any packet that's out of order gets dropped. So if you have a little jitter buffer in there, just enough to reorder a packet that comes in out of order, one or two packets that come in out of order, then you would alleviate dropping any packets by the phone on purpose. So that's another thing to think of.
All right. I'll tell you what, David, we're at the hour and a half mark, believe it or not. Wow. So people generally fall off after about 10 minutes. Yeah. So this is for the diehards. Let's do the wrap up, the closing. So, we usually go in reverse order for the closing. So especially the guests, I want the guests to go last. So Andrew Cox, if, people are going to get a hold of you out in the real world, how would you like them to do that?
Email is always best for me. admin@microtik-radars.com. No association with the real Microtik, but that's me.
Sweet action. Mike Hammett, if people are going to get a hold of you in the real world, I can't imagine why they would want to, but given the sadistic off chance, how would you like them to do that?
I mean, it's hard to not find me on the internet searching my name, but if for some reason you are unable to, I'm the guy that answers Buzzwiz Facebook stuff, so there's as good as anywhere.
Yeah, true story. All right, so if you want to find me, you can find me at gregsoul.com, the normal places, I guess. I kind of hang out here and there. David Ateas, if people want to get a hold of you out in the real world, how should they do that?
Well, I mean, email is a great way. David@pennytone, and that's penny like 1 cent, tone like dial tone, .com. So David@pennytone.com. But I also like to give my phone number. I'll give you my office direct number. It's 805-410-8022. I like speaking to people, so give me a buzz, because sometimes people send emails and they're not very descriptive. They're like, I have a Microtik problem, help. You know?
Gotcha. I can't wait to write that on a bathroom stall somewhere. It's going to be great. All right. So, everybody, thank you for joining us. If you want to get a hold of us, facebook.com/thebrotherswisps. Questions, comments. Mike is Johnny on the spot there. He is always quick on the draw. Also, if you're old school like me and you want to hit via email so you don't have Facebook, questions or comments, that's contact us@thebrotherswisps.com. Again, if you want us to keep adding additional content, good stuff, you got to ask us. Otherwise, we don't know what to tell you. I'm just going to sit here and make rude comments to David about New Yorkers in general. You got to give me some fodder. Give me something to put out there. So thanks, David. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye.